I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. We have a very exciting show for you today. Benjamin Alida Sines and I are going to talk to the poet John Hoppenthaler, who has two books of poems. The very latest one is called Anticipate the Coming Reservoir, and it's a fantastic book. On Poetic License today, we have a graduate student here at the University of Texas, El Paso, in the MFA program. He's a writer. He's from Arkansas, and he actually is my TA, a brilliant young man, Samuel Calvin Brown. How can you not be a writer with a name like Samuel Calvin Brown? Last night, John Hoppenthaler gave a reading here at UTEP. It was fantastic. A lot of people showed up. And John and I pretty much hung out at the Hoppy Monk for several hours, drinking beer and wine. Not both. I drank wine. He drank beer. And that's something we do a lot when we invite writers here. We drink. I don't mean excessively or anything, but we do hang out. And it was very nice because a lot of the graduate students came out from our MFA, our residential MFA. Benjamin Alida Sines came out. Some faculty came out. It was a really good time. But I had a good chance to talk to him. But we're really glad to have him. He's a very talented poet. He lives in the South now. He went from the East Coast to the South. So we're going to maybe ask him a little bit about that transition of going from New York to wherever he is now. Join us. It's going to be a great show. We'll be right back. John Hoppenthaler is author of two books of poetry, Lives of Water and Anticipate the Coming Reservoir, and both of them are from Carnegie Mellon Press. His third collection, Domestic Garden, is forthcoming also from Carnegie Mellon in early 2015. His poetry has appeared in Plowshares, Virginia Quarterly Review, McSweeney's, Southern Review, and it goes on and on and on. We're very glad to have him in the studio today. John Hoppenthaler, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
And I have right here on the table two books. One is called Lives of Water, and that's your very first book of poems. It's by Carnegie Mellon Press, which is an excellent press. And then another one called Anticipate the Coming Reservoir, which is also by Carnegie Mellon. But you also have a bound manuscript on 8.5 by 11 paper that you printed out, and that's your next manuscript.
It is indeed. Domestic Garden will be out in February of 2015.
Oh, that's nice. Domestic Garden. That's a very John Hoppenthaler title, I would think, because you're all about the peaceful places, the gardens, the retreat-like environments.
Well, the irony is, well, I got married, so hence the domestic part, but the irony is I'm not really a gardener, but it's a great metaphor, isn't it? It's one of those metaphors.
Well, I'm not a gardener. I'm not a gardener either, but I could spend hours within one.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about your new book.
The new book, in some ways, is a departure, and in some ways, you know, carries on a lot of the interest that the first two books have. The setting kind of changes from what has been my traditional setting, the landscape of the New York area and a few other places. But now that I've lived in North Carolina for 7 years, some of the new poems are set there. Mm. And so this book, in some ways, is an adjustment of landscapes because they're so different. And then I have the landscape of my personal life, which is shifted significantly as well.
Right.
Just before I turned 50, I got married.
You waited a while, huh?
I waited a while and gained a stepson at the same time. So my life has changed in so many ways, as Neil Young says in a song. And, of course, I got a job, a real teaching job.
That's nice to have.
And went through the tenure process and all of that. And so there's been a lot of shifting and changing in my life. And I think this new book reflects a lot of that in some ways.
So you got married at 50. Tell us the story of how that happened.
Well, way back when, about 17 or 18 or 19 years ago, I was at in Morgantown, West Virginia, a PhD student at WVU, West Virginia University, and I fell in love with one of my students. I was teaching a graduate course at the time, even though I was a PhD student. I was very fortunate to be able to do that. And she was with somebody else, and after she took me for a couple of classes, we kind of, I kind of stole her from her then boyfriend. But it didn't last that long, and a couple of months later, she decided that she had made a mistake and went back to him. And I was devastated and heartbroken, and of course, being a poet, wrote some poems about that, which later showed up in my first book. So flash forward about 10 years, I was then at the McDowell Artist Colony writing some poems and enjoying myself in Robert Frost's Deep Dark Woods, and suddenly got the urge to check my email at the main house and went there, and there was an email from this woman who I dated 10 years ago and was in love with, who had dumped me. And as it turned out, her marriage, she ended up marrying the guy she was with at the time, and the marriage didn't work out. She had had a son in the meantime. And she saw that I was going to be going to West Virginia for a writer's conference, the West Virginia Writers Workshop. And she said, you know, it'd be nice if we got together, it'd be nice to see you after all these years. The way she kind of worked up the courage to get in touch with me was that she had Googled me and online found a poem that was about her. And she liked that poem, and she bought my first book, and so there was another poem about her in it as well. And that's kind of how the rest is kind of history.
How did she know it was about her?
It has her name in it.
Okay. Yeah. That's a big giveaway.
That's right. So that's how it happened, and we've been married for 3 years now, and we're doing pretty well.
Does domesticity change your writing?
It probably doesn't change my interests. As far as being a writer, subject matter, of course, changes some. But the manner in which I find time to write has changed a lot, because as a single guy, I could, stay up all night and write and it wouldn't be an issue. But now, I have a son, I have responsibilities, and to find the time to write is different. So that has to affect, I think, my process and the poems in some way, because the way they originate is now different, largely. I used to be able to go to the beach and sit on the beach all day and write poems, and I can't really do that anymore.
Well, there's a story about how long it took you to publish your first poetry manuscript. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I got my MFA from Virginia Commonwealth in 1988, and, was naive and gung-ho and thought this is going to be great. I don't think my teachers there were as enthusiastic about my work, and I really wasn't very good at that point. I was lucky to have gotten into the program, I think. But I kept trying, and at some point, the poems just stopped happening. I was writing these very short, little, nuggety things that really weren't interesting me. I wanted to be able to move down the page in a more narrative way. And so I thought, I was working as an adjunct at a community college and in another university in New York, just living that horrible adjunct life.
Freeway flyer, we call them in California.
Yeah, just dreadful, and I feel so sorry for folks who are forced to do that. And the poetry just stopped happening for me, so I said, I better go and get a PhD, an academic PhD, because that's all that there's going to be left for me. And went to West Virginia with that in mind and had finished all my coursework when we did a poet search, and because I had an MFA, they allowed me to be a PhD representative on the poet search, and we hired a poet named Jim Harms, who has become a great friend of mine. And Jim was there, so I said, well, I might as well take his workshop. And something happened in that workshop, and the magic came back, and I was able to go down the page the way I wanted to, and suddenly the academic PhD was much less interesting to me. So here I was with that quandary in mind. And I was talking to a friend of mine who was Toni Morrison's caterer, who still is Toni Morrison's caterer.
Toni Morrison, the writer.
The writer. And I had bartended for Toni a couple of times in some earlier years at some of the parties she threw. And he said, well, Toni's looking for an assistant, and she knows you, and you've taught her work on the college level, so why don't you send her your CV? And so I did. And a couple of months later, I got a phone call from Toni, and She said, I'd like to interview you for the job. And I went and got interviewed and got the job. And so did not finish the PhD at West Virginia University, but got from there the things I kind of needed to succeed, I think, as a writer in some ways. So then I worked for Tony and was able to finish my first book while I was in her employ, because I didn't work very hard and she was wonderful about it. And wrote most of that first book, you know, working for Tony, and thank goodness the book got taken, and the rest is history, I guess.
So how many years did that take to publish that first book?
Well, the first book, the first book came out in 2003, and I got my MFA in 1988, and that's really where some of those poems maybe had their, so 15 years,
wow.
Really.
That's so, persistence.
And I think that's what's required. I tell students all the time, there's so many MFA folks who, you know, they get their MFA, they go out in the world, they get rejected. And the next thing you know, they're not writing anymore. I'm like, well, why did you spend all this money on an MFA if you weren't really going to take it seriously? Mm-hmm. So if I can offer any advice at all to writers, is just be persistent, because you never know when the right set of eyes are going to fall upon your manuscript.
Yeah.
It's largely luck. You make your own luck at a certain point, but you have to be a pretty good writer. But you just never know who is going to be attracted by your work at the right time. And
right, and after rejection, a writer begins to question his or her ability. Mm-hmm. And say, well, maybe I'm just not that good.
Mm-hmm. and, you know, we always have that. But at some point, if you really love it and you believe in what you're doing, you just keep at it. And that's what I did. I guess either I was too thick-headed or whatever, but I just kept going and found that piece of luck when I needed it.
Oh. Who were some of your literary influences?
Early on, I was influenced by mostly male writers of the early contemporary period, probably people like Theodore Retke and Richard Hugo and Galway Kinnell and James Wright and Bly early on, because I was writing a very kind of small imagistic poem early on. There was also Maxine Cumin, Robert Lowell, certainly. Later on, much later on, once I became a PhD student and began to be shown the work of some poets who I had neglected, Frank O'Hara, and a lot of women poets who I had failed to recognize as being important, I suddenly, I think that all helped me develop, find my voice fully and develop the voice I had, and allowed me to move forward in directions that I wanted to go. And so those folks certainly, and I'm very eclectic by nature, so even some fiction writers had something to do with the way I go about poetry. The magic realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for example, was interesting to me. The humor of Kurt Vonnegut was important to me. Mm. And I think all that stuff found its way into my poetry one way or another. And today I find some of the very young poets, the people in their 30s and late 20s, writing just phenomenal stuff, and I find myself influenced by the things they're doing, especially young women poets. There are some phenomenal young women poets out there. I think of Katja Kuipers and Anna Journey and Tracy Brimhall, Honoree Jeffers, and Natasha Trethewey, and you know, they're remarkable, and I find a lot of joy in their work, and I also see some of the things they're doing, and I think it kind of leaks into my own work in some ways, too.
Have you ever thought of writing in any other genre?
I write some creative nonfiction because I worked for Tony, and because there's a kind of thought. Anyway, I don't know if it's reality. You guys write fiction, so you would know better than me that the fiction pays better, or, you know.
That's what they say.
I tried to write fiction, but for some reason, my mind doesn't work in that more extended way that I think a fiction writer needs to work. And I tend to work by the short burst of energy, which seems perfect for poetry. My creative nonfiction then kind of starts with almost a poetic impulse, and then I'm able to take outside information and weave it into it in certain ways. So creative nonfiction is really my second genre.
So what is the most difficult thing for you about the writer's life, the poet's life?
I love most of it. The hard part for me is finding the time to write. It really continues to be that, and it's hard for me to find that space to be receptive to the world, to allow those synapses to fire in a way necessary to write poems. I need to leave the world behind in a kind of way, and I need to change location. I can't write poems at home. I've never been able to do that. I sit there, and there are all these familiar objects and the cats and the dog and the familiar noises, and I just feel brain dead there. I mean, not, you know, my everyday life isn't being brain dead, but as far as finding the artistic space to write poems. So I've always written best by going somewhere else. When I was a young single guy, I would go to the Jersey Shore for the day, spread my blanket, and lay there on the sand and write poems and be inspired by the sounds and the smells and of the ocean. So as a result, I write a lot of water poems. And I loved to fish as a child, so sometimes they go back to memory to those rivers and streams and ponds that I would fish in. Lately, I have some great friends who have a house in Virginia on Lake Anna, a vacation home, and they let me go there during my breaks, and I write there. I used to go to artist colonies a lot, and those were always my second book, many of the poems there were written at the McDowell Colony in a three-week space. So that's probably the hardest thing, just to get my head in a place where I'm not thinking about the next bill that I have to pay or picking up my son from school or whatever the case might be, just finding the time to let my mind drift.
We've been talking to John Hoppenthaler here on Words on a Wire. We're just about out of time, but we'd like to ask you to read a poem when we have a poet on the show. We always ask him to read the poem of the week. So, John, would you do us the pleasure of reading one of your poems?
I'd be happy to. Well, Daniel asked, I read this poem last night as the last poem in the set, and Daniel asked me to read it today, so I'm happy to do so. When I'm on the road, I have a guilty pleasure, and that is all-you-can-eat Chinese buffets. And you out there in Radioland can't see my girth, which has grown in the last few years. Domesticity can do that to you too, I guess. But my wife isn't happy about me going to all-you-can-eat Chinese buffets, so it's something I tend to do when I'm giving readings on the road and I'm driving.
A transgression.
That's right. And a safe, relatively safe transgression. And that kind of gets in this poem too. So this is called Dinner at the Walk and Roll Buffet. Guilty is how I feel on the road. Floozies sing to me from the hotel's lobby bar. Floozies seem everywhere, multiplying as if I travel a hall of mirrors. But across the service road is all I can eat. Watch me brave rush hour traffic and remain faithful to you. A Chinese buffet is where the overweight take their last meals. It worries me to death that I'm here. Try not to stare. Consider instead the grease congealed on your china. Every trip to the trough requires another clean plate. Signs are hung to remind you. The dishes are scratched. Decorative rims have faded with the washing. A Chinese buffet is a whorehouse. Still, fat people arrive. The hostess loses her face. She whispers in her daughter's ear, tell them in back, more kung pao, more beef on a stick. She dreams thousands of deep fryers orbiting Earth, watches them glisten like stars. The fat people change and grow unearthly. Unaffected by gravity, they gracefully maneuver space around steam tables, steel serving spoons held daintily in their swollen hands. Walk music clatters through the tiny kitchen window. She hates this dying from hunger. She hates how her face changes when she sees them at the door, the fat ones, the sad ones. How the restaurant loses money on them. How, after eating their weight in egg rolls, they rise. Coke-bloated angels, generous tips blazing the red tablecloths, as if generosity could make up the difference, as if guilt was a toll road and here I've paid. So good night. There's ice cream on a chubby boy's shirt. He's smiling, and his oversized eyes are absurdly beautiful. I've given in my love to desire so that I might die fat in your arms.
That was lovely, John. Thank you for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you both. I've had a great time here in El Paso.
I'm Sam Calvin Brown, and I'm a student in the bilingual MFA at the University of Texas, El Paso, and this is my poetic license. Workshops don't work. I know that's a strong statement, and it's a statement that could get me into trouble. After all, I'm a student in an MFA program, one that uses the workshop method. My professors use workshops, and most of them were in MFAs that used workshops. The truth is that they don't work. But the problem is not really with the workshops. It's actually with us, the students. Too often we fail to understand the true function of workshops. And it's important that we do understand. Because if we don't, workshops will never work for us. If you're in a workshop, you'll bring in copies of your work, a poem, a short story, a chapter of a novel, and give those copies to your fellow students and to the teacher. The students and the teacher will read your work, and then they will critique it while you listen. Sometimes the teacher mediates the workshop. Sometimes the student does. Sometimes you get a chance to speak, sometimes not. But the gist is that your work will be studied largely in terms of how it works or doesn't work. Things like dialogue and narration, free and direct speech, image, voice, character, pacing, all the techniques that writers use in linguistic art forms. An important word to know here is the word how. How does this work? How is this used? How are readers meant to understand this character? How can this be improved? And in terms of how, workshops work really well. The problem with workshops, I believe, is that students don't understand them as how environments. Maybe the problem is that we don't understand the limits of the word how. We may come to think that how is the only thing that matters in our work, or that how is something interchangeable and separate from the story itself. But it's not true. An important word to know here is the word what. What is what? It's hard to say. Impossible, in fact. I can't tell you, and I'm confident that no one else can either. The reason is that what is something you will only learn for yourself, by yourself. Nothing will teach you. No MFA, no workshop, no question of how can ever touch it. When I use the term what, I don't just mean content. We can't separate the art we create from the ways we create it. That's something that we can get confused about when we don't understand workshops, and it's a reason why workshops don't work for us. A story is its characters, its setting, its mood, and its voice. The various techniques that it uses, and the frame too. Chapters, sections, paragraphs, words, pauses, breaths. And for each story or novel or poem that you create, all these different things will be one thing. The only way that work of art will work. All these things will come together and they will become the what I'm talking about. William Faulkner found his what when he created The Sound and the Fury. Herman Melville found his what with Moby Dick. Emily Dickinson, Toni Morrison, Charles Dickens, Roberto Bolaño, Philip Levine. None of these writers or their works are the same. No two have the same drive. No two write in the same place or of the same people. No two understand art or its creation in the same way. But they're all examples of the concept of what. They'd also all agree that workshops don't work, not when it comes to the concept of what. Workshops can help you to become a better writer, a better poet, a better storyteller. They can teach you techniques, practices, They can teach you how to build a character in a scene, how to use the passive voice effectively. They can teach you how to take criticism from others and how to criticize your own work. Workshops work when it comes to teaching us how to write. But workshops don't teach you what to write. That's something that's impossible to teach. And any workshop that claims to create writers, artists, and creators is a lie. If you use a workshop to revise your work for publication, then you're making a mistake. That's not what a workshop is for. If you publish something from a workshop, good. But that's not the workshop's purpose. Its purpose is to teach you how to use techniques without the burden of the what, the weight of that inseparable combination of technique, content, heart, and soul. Workshops are places to experiment, like a young doctor working on a cadaver. Leave your living bodies of work at home, out of the workshop. Give them to the handful of people you trust to help you as you figure out just what you are trying to do with that poem or story. The notion of what may sound silly or impossible. Well, that's art. That's the reason that not many people are willing to do what we do. We hold our creations, which is to say ourselves, up in the hopes that we can speak about the world and to the world and for the world. That is the what. Workshops will help us to get there, just like reading books, hearing lectures, talking over late-night beers, long walks, and sitting and staring into our own imaginations will help us to get there. But let's not believe that workshops work. Workshops don't work. If they did, then this thing we do called writing wouldn't be at all what it is. For Words on a Wire, I'm Sam Calvin Brown.
I'd like to thank John Hoppenthaler for joining us on Words on a Wire. Make sure you check out his latest book, Anticipate the Coming Reservoir, and look out for his new book, Domestic Garden, which apparently he is living in right now. Congratulations, John. And on Poetic License, I'd like to thank our graduate student here at UTEP in the MFA program, Samuel Calvin Brown. I'm Daniel Chacon. Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. Don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. To be the only place for me, a comedy of errors and I'm falling like a rubber net giraffe. You look into my past, well maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right?